We will start today with a review talk by Martin titled Loop Quantum Cosmology and Eulogy. How do you read that? Eulogy.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for asking me to give a review here, although it might sound a little sad at some point. But I'll first review some of these actual motivations of loop quantum cosmology and some of the topics which haven't really been discussed very much in the literature but played some roles throughout the years and which seem to become more important right now. So the motivation was, of course, initially to just take what loop quantum gravity gave us, especially mathematical techniques, and use it to improve Wheeler-DeWitt quantum cosmology. But the main idea was really to test the full theory, so it wasn't clear how much physics one can actually do at this time. And as we'll see later, it's still not very clear, but we'll get there. So the main advantages here were the well-defined kinematical representation that holonomy and flux operators give us in the full theory, and one can derive analogs or some related observable operators in reduced models. And then there are all these analytical techniques, and then regarding, well, somewhat closer to physics, there was the promise of an anomaly free Hamiltonian constraint, which would be very important to do actual space-time physics, which is not clear in Wheeler-DeWitt quantum cosmology. Now, it wasn't until a little bit later when these techniques had been developed more and tractable difference equations were derived that one could actually start thinking about physics, so deriving quantum gravity states and quantum space-time, perhaps. Now, of course, many things have happened since then, so one should go back and review this critically and see if these initial hopes can actually be realized. But first, some of these more technical results. So there are symmetric states, which allow us to define symmetry reduction at some kind of quantum level. So, of course, it's not a full derivation from loop quantum gravity, but there is some kinematical link between full operators and those that we use in mini superspace models. And I'll talk about this in more detail in some of the other talks of this session as well. Now, especially in isotropic models, but more generally, Bianchi models, when they are diagonalized, give us an additional simplification from SU2 to U1, and that's really what made all these detailed derivations possible. And it's not completely obvious, and as it turns out, it is still an important issue. So one cannot really just start from a U1 theory and then quantize it like a U1 gauge theory. But it's important, since the full theory is SU2 and non-abelian, it's important to include at least some of these features. And then sometime later, of course, this U1 was unperiodified to the Bohr compactification of the real line. Now, again, that will be important later. And this, of course, it is a compactification of the real line, but the term compactification is somewhat misleading because we already have something compact when we do holonomies, SU2 or U1. So the question is really how to unperiodify U1 to get something which is not periodic but still compact. And that's what the Bohr compactification of the real line does. So that works out well in these isotropic or diagonal models, anything that's abelian. And the reason why it works is this simple identity here. So if we take a U1 representation applied to some phase factor, a U1 element, where I split the argument into a connection component C and this parameter L, which is some kind of length parameter for the curves that we're integrating over to calculate holonomies. And there's no explicit integration if it's isotropic or homogeneous. Then that's just this exponential, and the group label here, the representation label, and this length parameter will always appear in this combination, so one can just merge them to this real parameter mu, and that's the representation label for the Bohr compactification. So that's how this unperiodified structure is obtained. Okay, we'll talk about this later, still just summer here. And then regarding physics, once this structure is available, one can use construction techniques that we have for the full Hamiltonian constraint, and we see characteristic effects like holonomy corrections or inverse triad corrections. And one can use this to address conceptual problems. Now, I think if you don't really see these problems when you look at papers these days, or usually all the papers throughout the years, but there are many issues which have been discussed. The first one is what I already mentioned. All these constructions are abelian, and it's not clear how they really capture the non-abelian structure of the full theory, which should be important in some regimes. So that was discussed just briefly in just a few papers, but somewhat related is the question of embeddability, which is still being discussed after several years and still being developed. So the question here is how these almost periodic states that we get from the Bohr compactification can be embedded in the full theory. And the problem here is related to non-abelian features. John might talk more about this in his talk. Because if you just take an arbitrary curve, you compute the holonomy for an SU2 connection, then typically it is not almost periodic. So the question is how these are related. So that is a different version of this of these non-abelian issues that that play some role here. A different question is the interplay of quantum corrections of different types, in particular holonomy corrections, which look like higher curvature corrections, but are not quite higher curvature corrections. And there's been a question for a long time how these terms can actually be derived in canonical quantizations, in particular the time derivative part. Now that question, that's been understood now, but in a related form it reappeared, or it appeared to be solved initially, but it turned out that it wasn't quite solved when this harmonic model for a free massless scalar was considered in detail. And in this model it's harmonic, so there's just no quantum back reaction, there are no higher time derivatives. So it seemed to be easy to discuss this higher curvature question just because it, they are not there in this particular model. It's like a free quantum field theory. But in general models, there should be higher curvature corrections, so that brings us back to the previous issue. And then finally, space-time structure. So, of course, in the full theory, there are some indications that there might be a certain type of anomaly-free quantization of the constraints. It's some motivation to consider simplified models to understand the structure. But then if it's homogeneous, the algebra, the constraint algebra is just completely trivial. So we don't really see any advantages of anomaly freedom or any implications of potential anomalies. So these were some problems which I guess may not seem to be very important, so they were pretty much ignored because one could do other things which were interesting. But now, on the rest of this talk, I'll try to bring this to a more recent status and try to argue that they are actually still important problems which one should address before one goes to more detailed discussions of physics. Kinematics. So kinematics is supposed to be the easy part, but it turns out to be, not so easy. So again, just a few details. So we have symmetric states as distributions in the full theory, or the different versions to construct it. And then to get a quantum representation, one can take the basic algebra, so holonomy and flux operators in the full theory, and restrict them to cubic lattices with edges along symmetry generators. So that would just capture the right degrees of freedom. And one can show that in abelian models, such as diagonal Bianchi 1, this just produces the operators that one would obtain if one would just start with the reduced mini-superspace model and quantizes using loop representation. So that's some kind of link between these models and the full theory. And it turns out that it's based on this identity, which I already showed, and here, just a little more abstractly, I guess, with the representations. So we have a U1 representation on the left-hand side with some quantum number, and then with this combination of L and K, it can be turned into a representation of the Bohr compactification of the real line. Now, that's an identity when it's abelian, but it's not so clear how to do this in non-abelian cases. And that's where it's important to emphasize unperiodified structures instead of just compactifications, because SU2, of course, for holonomies in the full theory is already compact. But the question is how we combine these representation labels with these edge parameters that we have in holonomies to get something which no longer has this periodic structure of SU2, but is still compact and especially non-abelian with the correct commutation relations. And it's very difficult to do this. Now, it's possible to construct alternative representations which work for non-diagonal Bianchi-1 models, so they're no longer abelian. And I just refer to this paper for details. But it turns out that it's unrelated to the Bohr representation, or this representation that we get in abelian models based on the Bohr compactification of the real line. One can restrict this representation to abelian models, and they're somewhat related to these standard representations, but just by an isometry, not by unitary transformations, which means that we lose information when we transform from these non-abelian representations to abelian ones. So somehow this degeneracy, which we can see here in the fact that it's just a product of these two parameters, which we can no longer isolate from each other once we go to the mu here, that information is lost in this non-unitary transformation. So even though kinematic is supposed to be easy, it's not the case here. So we don't really know what the correct kinematical representation should be, especially when it comes to non-abelian features. And now non-abelian features are especially important when we're far away from the identity. So that means, in some sense, large connections in the sense in which it's used in cosmological models. So large Hubble parameters or something near the Big Bang. So especially in these regimes, it should be important to have a representation that captures non-abelian features. But we don't really know what that representation is. One could use this one, but then it's going to be very different from the Bohr representation. Just to, I guess, preview some of these talks that will follow. So Jonathan, I assume, will talk about a projection that's related to this embedding question. So he will show that one can actually extract almost periodic functions from these full holonomies, which initially are not almost periodic, by some kind of projection. I guess he can correct me if I'm wrong with the summary here. And the good thing here is that he can go beyond these regular lattices that I mentioned in these previous constructions. However, in this projection, he has to assume that he already has some kind of Hilbert space and the representation for the reduced models, which in his case is this Bohr representation. So he assumes this structure. His techniques don't allow us to derive new non-abelian representations. And then the other talk here, Emanuele and Francesco, is an embedding in of U1 in SU2, so it does make it non-abelian. So in some sense, it's going back to where loop quantum cosmology came from as a non-abelian reduction, but it's much more detailed with techniques that have been developed in the meantime. Also here, I think they still assume the Bohr structure so far and try to extend this to SU2. And again, they can correct me later if I'm wrong about this. But one can probably relax it and include non-abelian features in a more non-trivial way, and then derive a new representation which captures those features, which, given indications that I mentioned on the previous slide, will be very different from the Bohr representation that we normally use, especially, again, for large connections. OK, so now, if kinematics is already difficult, dynamics certainly is complicated. I don't really have many new things to say here on this slide, but of course, we know that the dynamics is either ambiguous or ad hoc, depending on how one approaches it. So there are many different choices that one has to make. And especially for holonomy correction, so replacing C with an almost periodic function, or now if it's no longer a Bohr representation, maybe we don't even know whether it should be almost periodic. It's certainly not completely arbitrary, but there are many choices to be made here. Now, the standard choice that's usually used is this one, which is doubly ad hoc, so the actual parameter is related to the area gap. That's a choice. And the A dependence as well is chosen to be of this form. Now, there's some motivation given constructions in the full theory, but if one reduces these to isotropy, one doesn't get 1 over A here, but some other power of A. So it's a motivation for some A dependence, but not necessarily of this specific form. So again, ad hoc, or if one keeps these parameters free of the A dependence, it's ambiguous. The second issue here is related to effective kind of equations, so I'm not talking about details, so just in quotes here. So if you look at holonomy corrections, so anything of this kind of the form of this modification here, then we can view it as an expansion if we go to larger and larger curvatures. So the first correction is of this size, so a quadratic term in the Planck length, depending on what mu bar is, times C over A, which is the Hubble parameter. Now, that's exactly the same magnitude that we expect for higher curvature terms or higher time derivatives that remain in homogeneous models. Now, the latter, these corrections here are absent in harmonic models, or if it's not exactly harmonic, usually these days one chooses a Gaussian state, which has weak quantum back reactions. So that's not the actual interacting, the analog of the interacting vacuum state of quantum field theory. So it's not the actual dynamical state that will tell us what the strong quantum regime near the Big Bang should look like. So by assumption, by assuming this kind of state, one assumes that there is no back reaction, and that means no higher time derivatives. But that doesn't mean that they're not there generically. So if we just keep all these terms in the sine expansion, so that means going to arbitrarily high orders in LP times H, then we cannot ignore higher curvature terms. If we do that, which is usually done, at least implicitly, then the approximation is not consistent. And that's an intrinsic inconsistency. We don't have to go beyond mini-superspace models and include inhomogeneity to see that these two different corrections compete with each other. So we cannot keep all terms in one term, in one correction, and just drop all the others. So to go back to the first slide, so what we actually have achieved in new quantum cosmology is not much compared to Wheeler-DeWitt. So with all these ambiguities, the Planck regime is as uncertain as it was before. So we don't have a concrete kind of set of quantum corrections. We don't have a general picture of effective equations, even in isotropic models where things should be easier. And so it's difficult to talk about Planck scale physics. The last point is space-time structure. And that is something which does not appear to be a problem in mini superspace models, but if we try to go beyond them, include inhomogeneity, then it becomes very severe. And it's one of the problems here that is actually relevant for the full theory as well, because the full theory has to deal with these same issues. It's related to background independence, and I guess what we haven't realized initially in new quantum cosmology, or probably in new quantum gravity in full, is that we don't really know what we're getting into if we start without any background space-time structure and hope that at some point it will be derived or emerge in some way. So it's not at all guaranteed that we get our familiar space-time structures. And these extensions of loop quantum cosmology to inhomogeneity have shown that this is actually the case. So here, canonically, we can talk about space-time structure in terms of the hypersurface deformation algebra of constraints, which will be modified. They have quantum corrections, just as these background equations in isotropic models have corrections. If they're not modified, there are no loop effects at all, and we're not doing loop quantum gravity. As Aurelien, I think, talked about this morning, these modifications can be consistent only if the algebra is deformed. So the algebra is deformed, which means we don't have the classical space-time structure. There's still some space-time structure, which is a good thing, but it's not classical. And there can be drastic effects, which he probably talked about in more detail. If this coefficient can turn negative, and then there's things like signature change, which is something which one has to take into account in these questions as well. And I'll talk about this later. But first, just having a deformed algebra means that gauge transformations are no longer space-time Lie derivatives. So we don't have the standard coordinate structure of this deformed space-time model that we obtain. We don't have a Riemannian structure because anything we could write in this form, like a line element, would not be invariant, because GAB would be subject to these modified gauge transformations. And if we use standard coordinates for Riemannian space-time, then the dxa, dxb terms transform just by the classical coordinate transformation. So this combination will no longer be invariant. And even more generally, you don't have standard tensor calculus because a tensor is something that transforms under coordinate changes in a certain way. But now we don't have coordinate change. So we have different tensor transformation laws, if we can even write tensors, but it's not clear if that's possible. So all these structures are no longer available. So that's what we're getting into if we start with a background independent formalism and try to rederive space-time concepts. But it's still consistent as a space-time model in terms of observables. In cosmological perturbation theory, for instance, one can derive the curvature perturbation and see how it behaves and what it predicts for observations. And typically, one obtains equations like this, or the same deformation function that we have in the algebra appears in these wave operators. So now, in this case, of course, there's a time derivative here, but that's just the standard construction that one does in cosmological perturbation theory. So we use observables for the inhomogeneous constraints, but we just evolve along the gauge trajectories of the background constraints, and that's how one can get this coordinate picture. That's just standard cosmological perturbation theory, which works even if it's not classical space-time. So we have a modified equation like this, and now the big surprise is that we don't just have a deformed version of space-time. In some regimes, there's no space-time at all because beta typically turns negative at high density, and so this differential operator here is elliptic instead of hyperbolic, which means we don't have a well-posed initial value problem. There's no time, there's just four-dimensional, some quantum version of four-dimensional space. So we cannot evolve through this regime, which is typically at high density. And I think anything else, if that wouldn't happen, one could still probably deal with mini-superspace models, but that's, I guess the nail in the coffin. So if mini-superspace models, they don't tell us anything about these implications because they just have a trivial constraint algebra. That beta function just doesn't appear. Or in this terms here, you don't see the spatial derivatives. You just have the first part, which doesn't change. So mini-superspace models would just tell you that time still goes on and you can evolve a state or you can evolve effective observables, perhaps. But that would be completely wrong if beta turns negative and you don't have time at all. So mini-superspace models, without any warning, really, unless you compare with these larger structures, can go completely wrong. So for me, that's the main reason why mini-superspace models are no longer reasonable in this context. And that's an indication for something which is a much bigger issue, which I call, the light is for, I was giving a talk earlier this year at a conference, and Carlo was there, and he, in the discussion, he said that my talk reminded him of Karel Kuhatsch's talks, which I found very flattering, but he didn't mean it like this. And I think that's just a bad symptom of the disease that has plagued Lupin gravity. People are just ignoring the anomaly problem, and there was another reminder here in 2005, which didn't seem to do much. One must say that new people have been active about and very inventive about dealing with the anomaly problem, but usually it's just finding ways to evade it. And these are some examples. The first one is gauge fixing before quantization, which can capture the right spacetime properties if spacetime is deformed. And I've used it myself, so I know the dangers in here. And I don't mention papers, but you can find papers which I could easily criticize, some of my own papers. The second example is deparameterization, which of course is a very popular idea, and it has some advantages, but also here, first, it assumes some temporal structures, and usually it does not check for covariance, although it doesn't run into gauge issues because it deals with observables. It's not clear if it gives us covariant information, because usually we don't even ask what happens if we choose a different kind of internal time, and usually time is just chosen as an input just by throwing in dust or a free scalar field, for instance. So even though it is formally gauge invariant, it's not clear if it is covariant in any quantum space-time sense. And then, again, here the great danger is shown by a signature change. So in deparameterization, we can always choose some internal time, even if there's no actual time in the quantum space-time model that we're dealing with if we go to these consistent constrained algebras. So even if there's no time, there could still be internal time, which means it's just a formal parameter. It's not certainly not physical time. And then in something else you might have heard about earlier. So Ivan and collaborators, Ivan talked about this. They postulate a metric, not a classical metric, so there are quantum corrections which change it. But if the algebra is deformed and that's something that they don't check, then that metric doesn't exist. Even with quantum corrections, there's just no metric structure. It's not enough to just change the coefficients. It's the whole structure that's no longer available. And now in their case, it is just like deparameterization, it is formally consistent. There are no violations of gauge issues, for instance. But that's just because they solve some of the classical constraints and use the corresponding classical observables, and then insert quantum corrections only in this deparameterized evolution generator. But typically, and often in this case, the evolution generator is a combination of terms which appear in the constraints. So if the constraints are not quantum corrected, but the evolution generator, so some of their terms is quantum corrected, then it's difficult to see what kind of consistent space-time structure that corresponds to. So again, it's a way to evade the anomaly problem, but it doesn't solve it. Now, the current status, of course, is complicated, so we don't know if loop quantum gravity can be anomaly-free. There are some indications, some models, which do produce interesting versions. I think Madhavan and Casey will talk about this later at this conference. But we're not sure about the full theory, and we're not sure about general enough models in which we could deal with inhomogeneity. And as long as we don't know whether it can be anomaly free, and certainly we don't know what this anomaly free version should be, we can't really do any detailed physics, because anything we do, if it's not anomaly free, would be a violation of gauge issues. And then it's not a matter of approximation. It's not a matter of a term which might be small or not. If you violate gauges, you can just be completely off, even if it looks like a small term. So what one can do is one can certainly make suggestions. And I think the talks in the morning that I referred to did make suggestions about possible effects. But it's not clear how reliable that is as physics. And I guess what one can also do is something more negative. Perhaps one can try to find effects which can allow us to rule out the theory. And then, that would be physics as well. Maybe not as much desired as other suggestions, but that would be a way to test the theory. And maybe along the way, trying to rule it out, one can find a version that is actually consistent and anomaly free. But it's clear that mini superspace models cannot help us, because they are just too much restricted regarding these space-time structures. And then, as I well, explained in the beginning of this talk, even the kinematics is not very clear. So I would say loop quantum cosmology has failed, but in an interesting way. So what we can learn from the mistakes, well, they weren't really mistakes, but from the things that didn't work out. In particular, it's certainly not just the usual reservations about mini superspace models that, which are also well justified, but here it's more because we have all these detailed techniques from the full theory, which did help us not really to do reliable physics, but to test this particular framework and these models. So some of these techniques were borrowed, were inherited from the full theory, but it's important to realize that some of the problems, especially this anomaly problem, is also shared with the full theory. So at least regarding the problems, loop quantum cosmology seems to be a model of loop quantum gravity. But in the latter case, of course, one still has to see how these anomaly-free versions work out. So what remains is certainly a two-formal. So in many cases, these are formal manipulations, not formal in the mathematical sense. These are just formal manipulations which ignore issues like the anomaly problem, and then it's not clear where they lead us to. It's often improvised in these ad hoc cases. I take it that some people see it as a promising path, but for others, myself included, it looks more like a random walk. If we have to make these choices at all points in the construction procedure, then it's not clear if that's very reliable. And I believe it's also, there's too much hype. So given all these issues which are often ignored, loop quantum cosmology is still around, I think, because of this hype. But I think with these problems, one should be much more careful, and they might even lead us back to problems in the full theory at some point. So it's certainly interesting to study these issues, but I don't see what we can do to actually use them for physics, but of course, that's my opinion. So I stop here. Thank you.
Time for questions? No questions? Okay.
Thank you for the interesting perspective. I just want to make a question about the parallel with a model in general relativity. So there's this model, the Friedman-Robinson-Walker model, which is clearly wrong, right? The universe has inhomogeneities in it. And yet it's somehow puzzling that it works so well. Could you comment a little bit on sort of the so you bring up some issues which in loop quantum cosmology, which show that the simplest models have some significant problems or could in the regards to the full theory. How would you make that argument in the case of Friedman-Robertson-Walker and general relativity?
Well, your Friedman-Robertson-Walker is an approximation, certainly. It's a well-defined approximation, which could have been a bad one, but apparently it works well. In loop quantum cosmology, and I guess quantum cosmology in general, we do many things which we hope will be approximations, but there's no clear sense of what approximation that is, and that refers to all these issues that I mentioned here. This abelian reduction, it's not clear. Since we didn't really know a non-abelian representation for most of these years, we can't check how reliable this abelian approximation is within the non-abelian mini-superspace model, even. The anomaly problem, well, we don't have a relation between models and the full theory, so again, we can't say which terms we are ignoring, if they are large or not. And then it turns out that it's even related to gauge issues. So some of the constructions that we do violate gauge properties, and which we know now with hindsight. So initially it wasn't clear because, well, we didn't know what approximation we were doing. And if you violate gauge issues, it doesn't even make sense to ask whether the term you ignore is small or not. It's just completely unphysical. And that issue is much simpler in Friedman-Robertson-Walker because we know it's just the same classical space-time structure. We could do everything in terms of observables it's just more complicated. But we know it's still covariant. It's just a very specific class of solutions within the full theory.
More questions? Okay, I do have a question concerning the change of sign of this beta function. So I see this as a very drastic change. So you commented that it's like a change of signature. Do you see that as a nice result, or do you think this?
No, that's certainly, I must say, I find it interesting as well.
But
and first, when people, Juan Reyes was the first one, he told me about it, I didn't take it very seriously. And then Aurelion and others, they rediscovered it in cosmology, where it was much more explicit and much more intuitive. So yes, it is, I think it is a very important feature, but it goes beyond loop quantum cosmology, I would say. It certainly goes beyond many superspace models, because you just don't see this effect if it's homogeneous, because the spatial derivative term disappears, or in terms of the constraint algebra, you just have zero on the right-hand side, so you can't determine the sign or the value of this function beta. So yes, if you want to call this loop quantum cosmology, that's fine with me. It's still alive and still interesting, but it's not a mini superspace model. And instead, if you did try to reproduce something like this using just mini superspace models, you would be completely wrong, because you would just not see it. You would just think that the time that you have in your classical theory would still be there after you quantize, because that's what usually happens. If we quantize and it's not background independent and there are no space-time effects of this form. So I would say it's more like a warning sign. There has to be at least some inhomogeneity. Otherwise, we can't do reliable models. And it has to be in a consistent gauge structure like this. Or maybe there are other ways, but there has to be some consideration of consistent gauges.
All right, thank you. No more questions? If not, let's thank Martin again. Wait a couple of minutes because maybe some people want to come and we are ahead of time. Okay, I think we can continue now. Our next speaker is Stephen Gillin, who is going to tell us about homogeneous cosmologies in discrete quantum gravity.
Okay, thank you very much. So I don't have a lot of time, I guess, so I will just guide you a bit through the basic ideas that have come up in this recent work. So this is a new approach for doing cosmology in the full theory. So in this case, the theory is, or the setting we're working in is group field theory, but there are, of course, strong connections also to loop quantum gravity, spin foams, and simplicial geometries, and so on. And so it's joint work with Daniele and with Lorenzo, and hopefully we'll be able to finish also the longer paper. So let me just give you some introduction and motivation. So the general philosophy is that in order to need to make contact with some kind of effective physics at macroscopic scales that would be related to things we can observe and measure, it's important to be able to describe space-time geometries that look macroscopic, approximately smooth, something like our universe, and these need to be states in your quantum gravity theory. And so this has been, of course, a long-standing problem in loop quantum gravity and also in other approaches. And so I'm just mentioning some proposals that have been put forward in the past. So there's this old idea of weave states, and there's a large body of work on coherent states, and there's this idea of doing statistics of combinatorial geometries, and of course much, much more, which I have no time to mention here, really. So in particular here, I want to focus on this on the setting of homogeneous cosmologies, spatially homogeneous cosmologies. This is a particularly simple class of macroscopic spacetimes, but very important, of course. And so what I will show you is how to describe such geometries in group field theory as quantum states. And then once I've given you these states, I will show you how to extract the effective cosmological dynamics that these states satisfy from the GFT equations of motion. And so these states will be analogous to condensates. I'll come back to that in a moment. So what I need to tell you about group field theory is basically just on this slide. So I'm using a kind of Fock space picture. So this is just a reformulation of the usual group field theory formalism. And so what you do to construct the Fock space is you start with a vacuum state, which is the usual background independent vacuum, which has no excitations of geometry, no excitations of space. Then you have this field, which is defined on four copies of the group SO4. SO4 appears because we work in Riemannian signature, just for technical simplicity. And then you can act with this operator phi dagger on the vacuum, and this will give you this elementary building block of space. So this is, you can think of this as a tetrahedron, and it comes with these four group elements, which are interpreted as holonomies along these dual links, dual to the four faces. Or in the spin network language, this would just be a four-valent vertex of an open spin network. And then, of course, this is just a bosonic field, so you can act multiple times on the vacuum, and you can construct the whole Fock space, and you can construct arbitrarily complicated open spin networks, which are of this type. And the geometric data that's associated to these building blocks is here given by the holonomies, but you can use any of the three representations for GFT that we know. So by using a non-commutative Fourier transform, you can go to the Lie algebra variables, which I call BI. These are the usual bivectors associated to the four faces. So this is the sort of metric picture. Or you can do the usual Peter Weyl decomposition and have a spin representation. And then there is an issue of gauge invariance. So there is a notion of gauge transformations which act on the vertex of this that I just showed you in previous slide. And the invariance of the theory under these gauge transformations is implemented by requiring this fundamental invariance property of the field under simultaneous right multiplication of the four elements by some SO4 group element. Then you can do the non-commutative Fourier transform. You can look at the Lie algebra picture, and this translates to this kind of closure condition. So what this means geometrically is that the four bivectors associated to the four faces, they have to sum to zero in order to actually form a geometric tetrahedron. And in either of these pictures, you can use this kind of gauge invariance condition to restrict to three independent arguments. There's a second type of constraints which you need to impose, which are the simplicity constraints, which ensure the geometricity of the B, which basically means that the bivectors can be expressed as E wedge E in terms of some geometric tetrad. And then there is a second type of gauge invariance on these three independent variables, which correspond to local SO4 transformations, so kind of frame rotations. So these act, for example, by the adjoint on the three bivectors. And so in order to have, so all the geometric observables would be invariant under these transformations, so you have to make sure that you implement this in the kind of states you're looking at, and you're looking only at appropriately gauge invariant states. And so in the usual spin network language, you could do this, for example, by looking at closed spin networks, but this is not the only way you can do this, and I'll come back to this in a moment. So once you've implemented this kind of gauge invariance on the geometric data, you have, for each tetrahedron, for each building block that I showed you, you have a six-dimensional gauge invariant configuration space of geometric data, and you can parameterize that, for example, by these bilinears of the bivectors, or you can define these objects Gij. So this formula that I'm giving here is basically the inverse of the usual formula, which would define the bivectors in terms of three triad vectors. So by Gij, I would then just mean the contraction of Ei with Ej. And so you can basically compute these numbers, and then for each tetrahedron in your n particle space state, so basically in your configuration of n tetrahedra, for each tetrahedron you have six of these numbers, the Gij. But now the point of this construction is to associate this data with some underlying continuum geometry that could be of the type that I described in the beginning, so it could be spatially homogeneous, for instance. And in order to get such an interpretation, we have to think of an embedding. So what we do is we have some configuration of n tetrahedra. We fix a three-dimensional manifold as a kind of spatial hypersurface. And so we have to fix the topology of that manifold. And the requirement we put in is that there is a group action of some three-dimensional Lie group, which I call G, which acts on this manifold M. And then you think of some embedding where you put these n tetrahedra at n different positions in that manifold. And then you need to interpret this kind of geometric data as coming from some kind of underlying metric geometry. And the procedure we propose here is that these Gij's give you the metric at these n points where the tetrahedra are sitting, given in the frame that's given to you by the left invariant vector fields. So because you have a group action, you are given, you can fix a basis of left invariant vector fields, and that gives you a frame at each point, and that tells you on which basis basically you have to view these metric coefficients Gij. So you might think that this procedure looks completely arbitrary, but in the case of spatial homogeneity, which will be the only case that we're interested in at this point, what I will show you in a moment is that the only choice that's really relevant for the interpretation of this geometry is this choice of group G. So that's really the only additional input on top of the geometric information that we have in these GFT states. And to make this maybe a bit clearer, I have a picture here for the two-dimensional case. So I kind of stole this from Wikipedia. This is just a two torus with the group action given by the translations in these two orthogonal directions. So you would fix the topology of this spatial hypersurface, and then at each point you would have kind of two vectors corresponding to the two translation generators, which give you a frame, and then you put, I mean, in two dimensions these would just be triangles, of course, you put them at n points in this embedding manifold, you have geometric data at each of the n points, and you can interpret this as giving you the metric at these n points. And so this is a consistent interpretation. The objects that we constructed are should be viewed as diffeomorphism invariant quantities because they're constructed out of other diffeomorphism invariant variables. And so this is consistent with the interpretation that I gave you to just view them as the metric components in this frame given by the left invariant vector fields. And so then if the geometry you were going to look at as the reconstructed underlying continuum geometry, if you knew that that was spatially homogeneous with respect to the group action of the group G, then these metric coefficients would have to be the same at the endpoints in the manifold. I mean, this is just the definition of spatial homogeneity. But of course, the converse is not true because you've just, if you work with n tetrahedra, you reconstruct the metric at n points, you don't really know anything about the geometry anywhere else. So this is true if you work at some fixed number of tetrahedra. But now we can do something in the quantum theory, which is we can look at superpositions of states that get contributions from arbitrarily high numbers of these tetrahedra. So this is easy to do in the Fock space. And then we can construct the states in such a way that each of these contributions for each particle number n satisfies this property of being compatible with spatial homogeneity. And then if that property holds at any n, so for all these contributions, as I just said, then basically this can be interpreted as taking the scale at which the geometry looks homogeneous to zero. And therefore, these states, which have this property that I just described to you, really have the interpretation as macroscopic spatially homogeneous geometries. And a particularly natural class of such states is given by these GFT condensates that I'm defining here. So what you do is you look at some elementary operator. So here you have some kind of one particle operator. So this is just a superposition, basically, of these tetrahedra that I showed you before with these well-defined holonomies. You use some function sigma here, and this gives you some one particle operator. Here you have the analogous construction with a two particle operator, where you basically look at a dipole as your elementary building block. And therefore, this state is already gauge invariant by construction, whereas here you have to impose gauge invariance on this function sigma. And then you take the exponential of that, and you have that act on the vacuum, and this gives you this condensate state. And then if you expand out the exponential, you see that at each order, you get some n tetrahedra configuration, where each of the tetrahedra is basically in the same one particle or two particle configuration, which is just determined by this one function. So this is really analogous to what you would do in Bose-Einstein condensates, at least in the kind of simplest approximation. And so now you can use these states, and you can extract the effective dynamics that these states have to satisfy from the GFT equations of motion. And so this is the kind of the second step of this construction. So far what I showed you was just a kind of a motivation for writing down these states, but now you really have to check what the theory tells you for the dynamics of those states. So here I'm just giving you the equation of motion of a generic GFT model. So in terms of this GFT field phi, there's some kinetic term here and some potential here, basically. So this is completely general. And now this quantum operator is supposed to annihilate your physical states. And so what this means in particular is that you can multiply this equation by any operator from the left and take some expectation values. So all expectation values of this form have to be zero. And so now what you do is you plug in your favorite condensate state or some other state that you interpret as a spatially homogeneous geometry, and you check the kind of constraints you get from these type of equations for these so-called condensate wave functions. So the kind of profile function that I just showed you that defines the one particle or two particle configurations that you use now has to be constrained by this kind of equation. And so in a class of specific situations, you get something very interesting. So I'm just listing two of those here. So for example, what you can do is you can take this dipole condensate that I showed you in terms of this defined by this function xi, and you can take a potential which is of odd order. So for example, it's phi to the 5, which is the usual kind of potential you have in GFT in four dimensions. Or you can take a single particle condensate, for example, and you can look at some kind of weak coupling limit. In either of those cases, you will only get a contribution from the kinetic term. So the interaction term will not give you a contribution. And this equation that you got from this vanishing of the expectation value before, which is in general nonlinear and non-local, now linearizes. It just gives you a linear equation, for example, in terms of this function xi. And so now this can be interpreted as a kind of quantum cosmology equation. If you accept the interpretation of xi as some kind of usual quantum cosmology wave function. And so, I mean, this is completely general. You can now make some assumptions on the model. So what we make is the assumption, for example, here, that you can have a kinetic operator which consists of a Laplacian on the group plus some mass term. So then the equation just reduces to this. Again, this is still a quantum mechanical kind of wave equation, but then you can look at a semi-classical limit. So this is just a standard WKB approximation, writing psi as amplitude and phase, taking kappa to zero. that reduces the equation to an equation for the holonomies and for the conjugate momenta, which are the bivectors. And then there are some more assumptions. So we assume that the geometry is near flat, so that the holonomies are close to the identity, and that the geometry is isotropic. And then within this regime, we approximate basically the equation we had before by just writing everything in terms of one scale factor A and the conjugate momentum P. So P is the conjugate momentum to A squared in particular. And then what you find is that this kind of GFT condensate has to satisfy at leading order in this kind of semi-classical approximation exactly the kind of Friedmann equation you would expect for an empty universe with some spatial curvature. So, so K has to be positive in these classes of states, and these are just the first corrections that you get, which come in the WKB approximation. So let me give you my conclusions. So I showed you a very general procedure in the context of group field theory, where you can start with a discrete geometry given by a state in the Fock space, and you ask which continuum geometries are compatible with this. In particular, we focused on the geometries that are spatially homogeneous, and I gave you a class of these condensate states that can be interpreted as these spatially homogeneous geometries. And as I said in the beginning, there's also, of course, close relations to other approaches. Then I computed the effective dynamics satisfied by these states. And in a specific case with certain assumptions on the GFT model, you actually find the Friedmann equation for an empty universe. So this is a nice, interesting starting point. What we now have to do is, of course, we have to do the same thing in Lorentzian signature at first, which is simple. Then we can add some kind of matter to make it a bit more interesting. And in particular, we have to add some kind of perturbations to go away from homogeneity. Thank you.
We have time for a few questions.
So you showed us the Friedmann equation, which you obtained. Do you have any idea what the leading quantum gravity corrections to that would be?
That's an interesting question, of course, and an important one. So there are several kinds of approximations that are made along the way. And so you could, for example, you could just look at the first leading contribution from the WKB approximation, but you've also made all these other assumptions. And I think what we have to understand much better in the further analysis is how they compare to each other. So which one would be the stronger approximation to actually have a better idea of what the corrections would be. But of course, this is something we have to work on. Thanks.
So I'm a bit confused by the states that you use, because from what I have understood, the way in which you impose homogeneity is just to take all the Gij to be all the same. And I don't understand how, in which sense, the states that you have, they are a Bose-Einstein condensate.
Right, so this is just an analogy. So, I mean, this is not relevant for the construction at all. I'm just saying that in Bose-Einstein condensates and in kind of similar many-body systems, these are states, I mean, these are coherent states for the kind of operator, for the field operator, for example. I mean, this kind of state built out of the one-particle excitations. And therefore, they have particularly nice properties because they're eigenstates of the field operator. So this one is a bit more complicated because it has this two-particle operator. And so in Bose-Einstein condensates, you could, for example, you would naturally have some kind of interacting equation of motion, and then you could make this kind of ansatz for the state, and this would give you the Gross-Pitayevsky equation. So what we have in cosmology is basically the analogous kind of ansatz and the analogous derivation, and so what we get is basically equivalent to the Gross-Pitayevsky equation. But this is just an analogy that kind of is supposed to help with your intuition.
Sorry, but, well,
I think the question was,
we have very few time, very little time.
Yeah, in which sense these were? I think the question was, in which sense these states were analogous to Bose-Einstein condensate? That's what I understood.
Okay, last question here.
So you create a bunch of identical tetrahedra. Mm-hmm. Oh, are they connected to each other through the faces, or are they all separate?
So in this approximation, they are separate. So this is a kind of an approximation where you have essentially weakly interacting particles, and they don't really talk to each other. Of course, you would, in order to improve this kind of state, you would want to add some more kind of multi-particle correlations. And this is something you should do in order to get the corrections to these kind of simple states. But at this stage, it's really just a kind of gas of tetrahedra of dipoles. That's basically the picture you should have.
OK, and sorry, we don't have time for more questions. So let's thank Stefan again. Our next speaker is Emanuele Alessi. He's going to tell us about, sorry, I need to look for the PDF first.
Okay. Can you hear me? Yes.
Okay. Emanuele is going to talk about quantum-reduced loop gravity.
Sorry, this will be... Okay, this work has been done in collaboration. No. This work has been done in collaboration with Francesco Cianfrani, and essentially we were trying to answer to the following question, namely, if you want to do cosmology in loop quantum gravity. Normally, you start from the classical theory, you reduce it, you end up with some mini superspace model, and then you quantize with some loop quantum gravity techniques. But our question was just about what's happening if we try to revert the order of reduction and quantization, namely, what kind of cosmology can we get from the full theory if we try to implement in some way at the quantum level, the symmetry reduction that we want to consider. Because in this case, we could also have space to treat in a single consistent theory also the inhomogeneities. Still listening? OK. So there have been some attempts. No. Yes, there have been some attempts to merge in the full loop quantum gravity, to merge loop quantum cosmology in the full theory, and this is our proposal. So we were trying to say, okay, let's look at the inhomogeneous line element in the BKL conjecture, namely, let's look at this metric, and this is nothing else than the usual metric you would find is a Bianchi 1 model in which you just introduce also a dependence, an X dependence on the volume and on the anisotropies, in those beta parameters. And those are the one form that characterize the Bianchi model that you can choose. So these normally are used in this conjecture, and we were trying to find a quantum symmetry reduction of loop quantum gravity that could be compatible with this line element. Why? Because if you have a model that is able to treat this metric that also has this local anisotropies, then it would be easy to remove the anisotropies and you would have quantized in the same framework any Bianchi model, for example, or Friedman, Robertson, Walker. So what we did is let's take that metric and let's write it in Ashtegar variables and let's try, those are the kind of Ashtegar variable that you would get. Note that there's no sum over I, and those are exactly the same variable that you would find in any loop quantum cosmology homogeneous model, only that note the dependence on X. So we were trying to say, can we find a kind of a quantum reduction in the full kinematical Hilbert space, the SU2 kinematical Hilbert space, such that those conditions can be imposed at the quantum level?
So to do this, obviously, okay, these are anonymous and fluxes. In loop quantum gravity, we have to speak about these are connection and electric field. We have to speak about anonymous and fluxes. So let's make this first truncation and restrict to anonymous along a curve that are along those edges that I label with this EI, where I goes from 1, 2, 3, that are the three possible directions, think to a cubic lattice, and with tangent vector that have to be parallel to the vector fiducial to the one form. If those are the holonomies, if those are the connection, if you try to build a classical holonomy with this condition on the connection, this is the SU2 element that you would get. But note, for example, think to Bianchi 1 in which those omega are just delta. Those one forms allow you here to essentially trade a tangent index that would tell you in which direction you are going in one of the three edge for an index in the internal space, namely those will be all, those generators will be always zero unless you are in the direction that corresponds to, let's call this direction EI. In only the generator in the direction EI would survive. This means that the holonomy, SU2 holonomy, that would be compatible with this restriction once that you are on those holonomies would be particular SU2 group element. Which group element? Some group element that have just the single generator that label the connection and also the holonomy. Because you essentially are using those omega to trade the tangent index for an index in the internal space. So those would be the connection, the holonomies. So what would be, if you consider a system of surface that would be with normal vectors that are again in the direction of those omega, this would be the condition that you would find on the fluxes. Everything here is SU2, and for the moment everything is classical. But on this system of surface and links of edge, the classical reduction for the E would imply for this metric. Look at this as a matrix in the index I and k. So this is compatible with the classical reduction if this matrix is diagonal and if it's proportional to the P. What means this P? This can be related to the U1 theories that you have heard till now. So we would be happy if we are able to implement that this matrix is diagonal and that it acts as a U1 vector field, but never touching U1, always staying within SU2. How can we do that? This can be done, so I say this has to be diagonal. You can impose this second class constraint with the Gauss constraint to achieve the reduction. So to resume, we need the holonomies that have to be somehow just U1 group element along each of the three directions, and we need to impose that condition on the generators. So how can we do that in the quantum theory? Now we switch to the quantum theory, and we have a strategy to do that. We have to impose this reduction on the holonomy and impose this second class constraint. How? Okay, well, we copied from spin forms. Namely, our idea was to impose this second class constraint weakly, so on the state, in such a way that we could find the physical Hilbert space. How? First imposing a master constraint strongly. Sorry. This master constraint strongly acting on the holonomies would act in this way. Namely, this would establish a relation between the think of this matrix element of how they are usually represented in SU2. Those would be Wigner matrices, and there you would ask a relation between the magnetic indexes of the Wigner matrices and the representation of the Wigner matrices. So to solve this, so essentially you are asking that the Casimir minus the JZ square applied to the state would be equal to zero for each of the three directions, because you have three generators, three directions that correspond to the three directions in your lattice. So this can be used introducing coherent SU2 coherent state. So this kind of states would give you a base of cylindrical functions, a base of Wigner matrices. We are in the full theory. We are just looking at a particular class of states that satisfy those conditions. But those states would satisfy the strong quadratic equation that I proposed. So those would help you in solving the condition on the E. You still have to impose at the quantum level somehow the condition on the A. How to do that? Again, we copied from spin forms. The idea was to use projected spin network that, using the Dupuy-Levin map, allow you to take cylindrical function from a subgroup and embed it in a bigger group. In this case, if you play with U1 and SU2, you can find those nice functions. Those are SU2 functions, sorry, but with this beautiful property that, using this, if you take a U1 function and you use this propagation kernel that is trying to mix the SU2 trace with the U1 trace, you find that forcing a relation between the U1 quantum numbers and the SU2 quantum numbers, you can have functions that are completely determined by their restriction to their U1 subgroup. So these at the quantum level on the functionals directly would do what you cannot do because you don't have at your disposal the holonom, the connection, but you just have a class of cylindrical functions. So now we are taking those class of cylindrical functions that are determined by their restriction. They have a kind of analyticity property. So If you take the cylindrical function those cylindrical function allow you to embed a U1 inside the SU2, but you have three different U1, one for each direction, the one that classically corresponds to the three different tau i. And if you select for each direction the subgroup generated by the generator tau i that correspond to the direction i, you find those functional that have this particular form and that with those Wigner matrices projected in the coherent base in each of the three directions that are determined by the restriction, so satisfy the condition on the holonomy, and that satisfy the strong quadratic equation strongly, and as a bonus, they also satisfy the linear constraint, the chi-i, weakly, and they act as left invariant vector field, as U1 left invariant vector field. So this is how we find in the quantum theory the classical reduction. This is in complete analogy with the spin form quantization, in which you find projected spin network that implement weakly on a subspace of the SL2C basis element the linear simplicity constraint. I don't have time to enter in the details, but it's the same strategy. So if we define a projector on those physical reduced states that just kill in your theory whatever don't belong to graph of this cubic lattice and that has not function of that and you impose that the functionals here are just of our reduced space, you can project also you find a kinematical Hilbert space where the reduction has been implemented, and then you can proceed implementing the remaining constraint. If you implement the Gauss constraint, you find that the usual intertwiner has to be replaced with some reduced intertwiner. Your holonomy are the reduced holonomy that are just the basis element that I described before. And this is how the theory starts to look like. Namely, so once that you solve the Gauss constraint, you have spins. So this is like the full theory, but on this cubic lattice, in which you have reduced holonomy that corresponds to inhomogeneities. You have the space for different spins that correspond to anisotropies. So it's clear that if you put all the spins equal, you can have the homogeneous and anisotropic sector having the spins different in the three directions, or you can have even the homogeneous sectors acting all the spin equal. This was the full theory. We are just projecting every of the constraint. We can solve the S-knot using the S-knot techniques also, averaging over the diffeomorphism that preserve that graph structure. We can solve also the vector constraint. And then we can focus on the Hamiltonian constraint. Here we are not able to solve the Hamiltonian and then project, but we are able to regularize the Hamiltonian a la Tiemann, introducing the holonomies that belongs to our reduced subspace. We can compute the matrix element. This will act just like in the full theory, knowing about the full SU2 structure at the node. and adding new links, changing the spin, we can compute the explicit matrix element in this case, because the volume in this subspace is diagonal, and this is the action of the Hamiltonian. It's nice because this J corresponds to the P. So if we restrict to SL, this is something like 1 over J3, 1 over J2, 1 over J2, that means 1 over P2, 1 over P3, P2, P1, and with the information about the connection stored in the state, because this is just a simplified version of the full theory. Well, if you want to test if this makes sense, you have to do the semi-classical limit. To do it properly, you use coherent states. So we take the full coherent states of the full theory in their gauge invariant form. We project them in the subspace and applying them to a single cell at the leading order. This is the Hamiltonian that we find. So picking, so the reduction is consistent because we find the classical Bianchi one Hamiltonian. This is just for a single cell. There are a lot of things to do, but I'm out of time. Thank you.
So the model is very nice because it allows to make calculations in a simpler context. And I think you have already thought about this, but it seems to me that it's the right framework in which we can consider how the spin network states somehow homogenize on its own because of the properties of the intertwiners. So how difficult would it be to study this kind of problem in this context?
This is as difficult as doing computation in the full theory. The point is that I'm concluding saying that this is an arena for the canonical theory because the main problem with the full theory is the volume. Here the volume is diagonal. The rest is just a simplified version of a SU2 recoupling theory in which, namely, instead of it was not clear because I was running, but here the solution is that instead of considering Wigner matrices with arbitrary magnetic indexes, you just restrict to the maximum index. So this makes the recoupling theory much more easy. So in principle, to compute the whole action, you have to compute and answer to isotropization mechanism possible application. You have to solve the Hamiltonian on each of the nodes, and in principle this is easy if the nodes have all the same spin, and then I don't know, you have to see the collective effect after several steps with some kind maybe of averaging procedure, but it's you can compute computationally manageable.
I have a question in the same direction. So here, when you look at the dynamics, you'll have the universe that says expanding, for example. Here, will it really be the spins and the intertwiners that are changing, or will the graph itself be changing and adding new edges and new nodes and so on?
You can play with the religion that you prefer, in the sense that there is, if you like the algebraic approach, you would not change the graph and just change the spins. If you are if you like the original formulation with graph changing, it's the same. In what I said, for example, are only the matrix element that change, but the structure is like in the full theory. So if you think to spin foam and you want to change graphs, you can do that. You only have to respect the fact that there is this cubular, this cubic structure that has to, this topologically cubic structure that has to be preserved. For the rest, if you like, for example, the anomaly freeness property of the first demonstration of Tiemann constraint, in that case, you need to add graph changing. But this is a question of the full theory. I'm saying that those questions here can be addressed with computation.
I see here on the slides, which you didn't have time to talk to about, that you says some mentioned link to loop quantum cosmology. Would you like to say something about that?
Link to loop quantum cosmology is something that we would like to understand, but what I want to stress here is that for the moment, this is just like in the full theory. So the action of the Hamiltonian, it just gives you pure spin dynamics. So here there's no mu bar scheme. Those are Wigner matrices. It's a simplified full theory. Now, if you want this Hamiltonian that I find here is at the leading order using coherent state. Those states contain a length. A length is because those are kinematical states. The kinematical states have a length inside, because in loop quantum gravity you only have this length. So I think that one has to mix this kinematical length with the quantum numbers given by the spin to obtain something continuous, like the mu or mu bar, that is a continuous variable. But this Hamiltonian comes from something like sinus of the length, sinus of the length times the connection divided by J. And then using coherent state, you replace J in terms of the kinematical variables. So there is a length that appears, so the continuous parameter here appear only because you use coherent state that are kinematical, so have the coordinate length inside by definition. In the quantum theory, there are no continuous number, only discrete spins.
Yeah, so very fast. So the states you consider are actually, that's actually a preliminary comment, they are the same simple condensates that Stefan was talking about, to which you add the very precise type of correlations, the ones needed to reconstruct an hypercubic lattice, rather than having disconnected vertices. So the reason why we neglected those is that...
Those also have, and this is something that we have to think about, those also have a Clebsch condition.
No, also that, ours.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, it's the same thing. So the point is that neglecting those extra correlations, we of course simplify the state, and we are able to extract an effective dynamics, an effective closed equation of a quantum cosmology type. The question is whether you tried in the Hamiltonian equation you use to neglect those correlations and see what is the simplified dynamics.
This simplified dynamic, so if you neglect the correlation, you are letting...
The gluing, I mean. The gluing.
So you are letting each of your, let's say, six valent node, each of your cube being dependent from the rest.
Well, but they're all the same.
Yes, all the same, so it would be exactly. Many times the same Hamiltonian, so this would be Bianchi model directly.
Okay, very good. Thanks.
If you want to look... But if you want to put in homogeneities, that is what you would like, then the cubes have to be different.
Okay, let's thank Emmanuel again. Our last speaker before the coffee break is Jonathan Engel. You can use either that. Okay, Jonathan is going to speak about diffeomorphism invariance and dynamical quantum symmetry reduction.
Good. So, thank you to the organizers for this opportunity to talk about this work. This is some work that I'm doing with Christopher Beadle and my two students, Matthew Hogan and Philip Mendonca. Matthew will also be giving a talk on Friday. I'm going to be mostly talking about things more related to full loop quantum gravity. That's the emphasis of my talk, whereas Matt will be talking more about Bianchi 1. So because of that, my talk will be a little bit, I will be making incomplete statements. The work in the full theory is more motivational. In some sense, the reason why we look at Bianchi 1 is to show that the ideas can be fully worked out in a simpler model. But nevertheless, I think there's a lot of interesting things to be said. So the motivation is to try to understand better how loop quantum cosmology fits into the full theory. Of course, we've heard in many talks today that loop quantum cosmology has led to a number of things which can be called successes. It's one of the only places where quantum gravity is starting to make some solid contact with observation, or at least potentially. Loop quantum cosmology basically adapts the key insights of loop quantum gravity to cosmology, but in the end, it's really it's a derivation, it's a quantization of the homogeneous isotropic sector of gravity using loop quantum gravity techniques. It is not really derived from the full theory proper. And if we were able to derive it from the full theory, probably with some changes or corrections, there are things which one could learn something about. There are puzzles that exist in loop quantum cosmology. For example, the volume spectrum in full loop quantum gravity is notoriously very complicated, whereas in loop quantum cosmology, it's completely uniform. It would be good to understand exactly how that happens. Because in loop quantum cosmology, you have to gauge fix before you quantize, you don't have any diffeomorphism invariance. And because of that, the way you quantize the Hamiltonian constraint is different from the usual way that, or at least the original way that was proposed by Thomas Tiemann. Because the original Hamiltonian constraint proposed by Thomas Tiemann, the graph non-fixing constraint, required diffeomorphism invariance in order to remove the regulator. So instead, in loop quantum cosmology, you shrink the loop until the area reaches a minimal area eigenvalue. This eigenvalue comes from the full theory. This is a very nice, well-motivated prescription, but it's not completely satisfactory because this area eigenvalue just needs to be, it's parachuted in from the full theory. And also one can ask the question, if I'm shrinking a loop to a point, of course it's true that in the full theory that the area need not go to zero. It could go to the minimal area eigenvalue, but it could also go to some other eigenvalue. So if one could really derive the cosmological model from the full theory, one might obtain a more subtle prescription for the quantization of the Hamiltonian constraint. In any case, it's a very interesting question to investigate. So this general strategy which I take is to first try to define what I mean by the homogeneous isotropic sector in the full theory. So usually when you have a condition which you want to impose in quantum theory, the first thing you do is you formulate the condition in terms of your basic variables, and then you replace the variables with quantum operators. And then you impose the desired condition as an operator equation. The idea would then be to try to embed the states of loop quantum cosmology into the resulting sector. And then one could ask that this embedding intertwine operators which are of physical interest. So I have done prior work on this, which has been successful. This reference, so the last, I have a list of references at the end. But this last work is actually what Martin was referring to. And actually, it's not what I'm going to talk about. Because one of the disadvantages of all of these ways of embedding loop quantum cosmology into the full theory is that they all break diffeomorphism invariance. And this is because they start from a condition for homogeneity and isotropy which breaks diffeomorphism invariance. And because of that, the resulting sector doesn't solve the diffeomorphism constraint, so in that sense it's unphysical. But more importantly, because the resulting states are not diffeomorphism invariant, the original Tiemann constraint is not defined on them. So you can't even start to investigate the most interesting question, which is the relationship between the Hamiltonian constraints in the full and cosmological models. So in order to really answer the important questions, one really needs a diffeomorphism invariant embedding of LQC into the full theory. And to start to do this, we have to start by finding a diffeomorphism invariant condition for homogeneity and isotropy. So first let me explain why it's non-trivial to construct such a condition. Usually what one would do is one would fix an action of your symmetry group, which for k equals 0, the spatially flat case is the Euclidean group. You would fix an action via diffeomorphisms and gauge rotations on your basic variables, and then you would simply require that your basic variables be invariant under this action. But the problem is that if I choose some diffeomorphism and act with this diffeomorphism on a homogeneous isotropic phase space point, then this diffeomorphism transformed point will not be invariant under the symmetry group. So if we define homogeneity and isotropy by fixing a particular action of our symmetry group, it leads to a non-diffeomorphism invariant condition. So how can we get around this problem? Just roughly speaking, my idea was to try to impose invariance on something which transforms as a scalar under diffeomorphisms. Because then when we impose invariance under the symmetry group, it becomes the same thing as asking that it be constant, which in fact is a diffeomorphism invariant condition. This is just a rough statement. It becomes more precise on the next slide. So the idea is to take your basic variables and construct something which transforms as a scalar under diffeomorphisms. So the dual of the triad gives you this two-form field, and then you can also construct the curvature here. This sigma field at each point in spacetime gives us a basis of the space of two forms at that point, and so there always exists this matrix L. So the idea is to impose homogeneity and isotropy on this matrix L. So you can impose homogeneity just by requiring that it be the same at all points, and you can impose isotropy by requiring that its three eigenvalues be the same, which is the same thing as requiring that it be pure trace. And this is a diffeomorphism invariant condition. However, this is not yet strong enough. If homogeneity is already satisfied, this is enough to imply isotropy, but it doesn't imply homogeneity completely. So because of that, we decided to use a complexified connection using these complexification techniques developed by Thomas Thiemann. So this is the complexified connection that results when you use the spatial volume of the universe as your complexifier. And so it's easy to write down the operator corresponding to the holonomies of this complexified connection. And you just define a complexified version of L. So instead of using the usual curvature on the left-hand side, we use the complexified curvature. And now if we impose homogeneity and isotropy on this matrix, so if we impose that this complexified matrix be constant in pure trace, and if we impose another, we need a reality condition in addition to that, then these are necessary and sufficient conditions for the space-time to be symmetric with respect to some action of your symmetry group. So this is a diffeomorphism invariant formulation of homogeneity and isotropy in terms of equations which, in principle, can be quantized. And this is schematically how you would do it. So first of all, the curvature in the definition of your L here, the curvature you can quantize first by expressing it in terms of holonomies in the usual way. And what's nice is because we're interested in finding diffeomorphism invariant states, which satisfy this condition, we can actually remove the regulator. We can shrink the loop to a point. And then once you have this operator LC, then you can write down equations which your diffeomorphism invariant state should satisfy. This last equation is actually a little bit problematic, the reality condition. Like I said, in the full theory, there are still issues that need to be resolved. But the fact that you have problems with the reality condition is probably not so bad. Because if I drop the reality condition, it seems that all that does is that means that I include not only k equals 0, but also k equals plus or minus 1. The reason why it's problematic is because this LC operator is going to map diffeomorphism invariant states out of diffeomorphism invariant states. So it's not completely clear how to define the Hermitian conjugate, and so it's not completely clear how to define these real and imaginary parts. So we have these. So this is a very, these equations are difficult to solve. So what we do is we first look at a simpler case, which is Bianchi 1. And in this case, everything goes through very nicely in a way which is surprisingly nice, much nicer than I could have expected. So in this case, because we already have homogeneity, it's enough to use the non-complexified L, as I was saying earlier. And it turns out that whether we use the complexified or non-complexified L, we get the same sector of quantum isotropies. Matt will say more about the equivalence between those two ways of defining quantum isotropy. So in the Bianchi 1 case, you have, as your basic variables, classically, you have these three parameters, C, 1, 2, and 3, and their conjugate variables, P, 1, 2, and 3. And then the usual Ashtekar-Barbaro connection and densitized triad in terms of those parameters is just given by those expressions there. And just to give you some intuition of what these L matrices look like, in the Bianchi 1 case, I give you explicit expressions. What's nice here is that, so first of all, you see that the L matrices are diagonal in the Bianchi 1 case, and so you just have three non-zero elements. And in fact, from these three non-zero elements, you can construct any possible scale invariant quantity in the theory. So these are very natural quantities that you can use these quantities to construct basically anything else of physical interest. And Matt will also talk about that. But these are not the expressions we use to quantize it. The expressions we use to quantize it is the definition of LC. So what we do is, but fortunately, so the curvature appearing in the definition of LC has already been quantized by our friends Ashtekar and Wilson Ewing. They have really only defined, this curvature operator up to ordering. So what we do is we introduce some ordering parameters. This is the expression for the curvature. And we insert some ordering parameters, f, g, and h, which are arbitrary a priori. They're arbitrary functions of the p's, which are we require their product to be 1. So once we have these L operators, you can use them to impose the quantum isotropy condition. Basically, you impose that this be pure trace. Now, before I talk about this quantum isotropy condition, I want to take a small detour. Ashtekar and Wilson Ewing, in their paper on the Bianchi 1 model, where they define the Bianchi 1 model, they introduce a projector from the Bianchi 1 Hilbert space to the isotropic Hilbert space. And this is actually a dynamical projector in the sense that it intertwines the Hamiltonian constraints in the two theories. Now, if I take a projector, which is an onto map, and I take its adjoint, what I get is an injective mesh. So what I get is an embedding. And this embedding, it's easy to see, also intertwines the Hamiltonian constraint. So what you have is a dynamical embedding. What this shows is that the isotropic model is equivalent to a particular sector in the Bianchi 1 model, including dynamics. It's exactly equivalent, which is remarkable. And now we can ask a question. What is this sector? The image of this embedding, what does it have to do with quantum isotropy for some choice of ordering of the operators L? And in fact, I was quite surprised. If you just take the simplest possible ordering, that is, if you set all of the ordering parameters equal to 1, then in fact, they're the same thing. Or at least it's easy to prove that that the image of the embedding is contained in the sector of quantum isotropy. Containment in the other direction, we think it's true. We haven't completely proved it yet. But it's a very surprising result. A more difficult condition to be for these operators to satisfy is that they be intertwined by the embedding iota. And when you impose that, you get further restrictions on your ordering parameters. But Matt will talk about that further. And I'd just like to close with this last slide. So the embedding that I talked about, the embedding from the isotropic model to the Bianchi 1 model, has a very simple form. You notice here on the left-hand side of this expression, for explicit expression for the embedding, what you have is a particular choice of an eigenbasis of volume. And this definition has a completely obvious generalization to the full theory that you can just write down. And this embedding is, it's an embedding of isotropic loop quantum cosmology states into diffeomorphism invariant full loop quantum gravity, which at first seems very exciting and nice, but you immediately see problems with this. First of all, you see that it depends on the choice of eigenbasis of volume. It's not a dynamical embedding, and the image of this embedding doesn't have anything to do with the quantum isotropy condition, quantum homogeneity and isotropy condition I was talking about before. So again, these are incomplete statements. There's still work to do, but all of this is motivation for what for the completed work in the Bianchi 1 case, which Matt will talk about on Friday.
Questions? There is no question whatsoever? Okay. Do you want to say something else that you didn't have time to say?
No, I cut down my slides enough, so I don't have any.
Can you maybe tell us a little bit, is there any relation between your approach and Emanuele's analysis?
Well, I mean, the first basic difference was actually highlighted by Martin in his first talk, is that I'm always talking about embedding the loop quantum cosmology states into the full theory, whereas Emanuele is starting from the full theory and trying to impose some sort of homogeneity and isotropy. I mean, another difference is in Emanuele's approach, he's fixing a graph. Here, I'm not fixing a graph. But of course, in Emanuele's approach, it's very, because he's restricting himself to these graphs, which are only along these lines, it's more manageable. Of course, that's the trade-off. But that's exactly what I want to get away from, because I want to understand cosmological states in the diffeomorphism invariant context. It's a hard question. It's what I'm interested in.
Okay, thank you. Let's thank Jonathan again.